Broadcasting live from Prescott Valley, Arizona. This is the Progressive Technology Hour, and I'm your host, Bill Alec. Just to give you a little background about myself, I'm a degreed electrical engineer, and I currently do software consulting work for major corporations. That describes my day job. At night, I become Dr. Houdini, researcher, explorer, and experimenter in the world of exotic technologies. What are exotic technologies? Well, this includes such areas as free energy, gravity, anti-gravity control, the study of the nature of time and time travel. We'll explore not only the technology, but also the how-to part of the technology. So let's have some fun today and explore the world of exotic technologies. Folks, I have a special guest with me today. He's an experimental nuclear physicist, and his name is Dr. Robert Kuntz, Ph.D. Dr. Kuntz is attempting to create technology that will allow extraction of usable amounts of energy from the vacuum. This research follows the work of Nikola Tesla and Dr. Thomas Henry Murray. While working at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, Dr. Kuntz headed up a team of 12 physicists which looked for evidence to support the existence of a class of particles referred to as anomalons. Dr. Kuntz was recently a guest on Coast to Coast with Art Bell and on Dreamland with Whitley Strieber. Dr. Kuntz, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bill. How are you today?
Great.
Good.
Doctor, let's get into this this UFO experience you had back in the late 90s. And I think this is what brought you to doing this fascinating research and, you know, free energy and looking into anti-gravity type devices. Could you describe this experience you had?
That's exactly right, Bill. It was 2002 was the date, the year, August 8, 2002. I was driving from Altoona, Pennsylvania to Huntington, Pennsylvania, where I live, and I saw this track in the sky, an unusual track, and it brought my caused me to investigate it further, and I started taking photographs of this. I had a camera with me, digital camera. I took about 20 pictures of this thing. And it turns out that when I got home and blew it up on the computer, it had a flying saucer in it.
Whoa, a flying saucer, huh?
It wasn't just a
blob. Now you mentioned you took some photos of this, and this is on your website.
Sorry?
You took some photos, and these photos are up on your website. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's drkuntz.com, D-O-C-T-O-R, Kuntz, K-O-O-N-T-Z.com.
So the listening audience out there can go right to his website and check this out, folks. I mean, this stuff is for real. This is happening. And Dr. Kuntz has some photos you should take a look at here. So go ahead, doctor.
Well, I think they're fairly good pictures. You know, you never get anything the way you want it to be, perfect, but it's clearly a disc-shaped object. It's got a dome. Apparently, it was trailing smoke. Now, I'm not exactly sure what was going on with the craft. It appeared to have a little bit of a wobble. It was traveling maybe 15 miles an hour, I estimate, and very slowly. I was able to catch up to the object with my car, and I took more photographs. So all in all, I think it's pretty conclusive evidence that there's a disc-shaped object with a dome. There was a disc-shaped object with a dome flying around in our atmosphere. And so I know of no way that such an object could maintain its altitude other than some sort of anti-gravitic effect. And that's what led me into the study of anti-gravity.
Well, you know, doctor, I had a sighting myself. Okay, that was back in 1998. And the listeners out there can go to my website. It's intalek.com, and that's spelled I-N-T-A-L-E-K.com. And go down to the bottom of the index page, and there's actually a movie of what I witnessed back in the late 90s. This video was shot back in, I believe it was 1992, over Redfish, Florida. And so somebody caught this on video and uploaded it, and this was the same craft I saw hovering over the city of Tucson. In my opinion, this thing was a machine. This was an actual machine. It had no means of propulsion that we know of. Okay, keeping that thing up in the air. I mean, no jets, no propellers, none of that. So I can only assume that it was using this exotic technology, okay, that, you know, we're researching here today, you know, at least not in the black op world, but, you know.
Well, I don't know what goes on in the black op world, but in the world of physics that I come from, there is no known explanation for this phenomena. Anti-gravitic effects are outside the realm of normal physics as we understand it. Now I've come to realize that our laws of physics that we are taught in colleges are not correct. Well, they're correct, but they're not full enough. They don't include something,
that's correct,
some effects that we need to include.
Yes. It's very limited physics.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. If you had consider electrodynamics with gauge transformations, then possibly that will be a complete set of physics that will handle anti-gravity. But without gauge transformations and what they call, which also could be called scalar physics, to include scalar waves, unless you include that, then the laws of physics that we're working with in our colleges and universities is incomplete.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Doctor, I had a guest on my show. His name is Miles, Constantine Miles. He's a professor of electrical engineering in Germany. And I had him on my show last year. You know, people can go to the archives and actually listen to this fascinating show. He presented a little kit he was selling on the internet of people can actually build a Tesla power, you know, one of these one wire power systems.
Right.
And he gave a demonstration of this at Tesla Tech a couple of years back. And it was rather amazing. He was able to transmit power wirelessly.
Wirelessly or with one wire?
Well, with one wire.
Yeah, okay.
He was using one wire. Mm-hmm. And he was transmitting, you know, real power through the air. And he had a little electric boat that he was powering around this little pool of water. And, you know, I talked to him for a little bit, and he told me he was transmitting about 20 megahertz, you know, a signal, about 20 megahertz, transmitting using, I believe was a linear amplifier he was using. And his Tesla coil, it was the flat Tesla coil with some special modifications he made, and it was printed on a printed circuit board. So you can actually see that the Tesla flat coil imprinted
on a printed circuit board. That's probably a bifiller coil.
Well, it was just a single spiral. Okay, and at the center of the spiral, he had his antenna going up to a copper sphere.
Okay,
and his receiver, the boat, you know, had a similar arrangement, okay, with his spiral printed circuit board coil, and was just connected to an electric motor. And he was actually, you know, running this little boat, you know, in this pool.
I've seen this kind of thing before. A Borderland Press or whatever it's called there on the internet, they've had some videos of transmitting signals with transmitting, it seems like you're transmitting charges over the air. I mean, like you're transmitting charged particles. I don't think you're really doing that, but it has that effect.
Well, you know, he was emphasizing the fact that you know, he had worked out, you know, some of the scalar electronics, and he wrote a book,
right.
And it's available for download off the internet.
I was going to say scalar physics because around that frequency range that you're talking about there, there's a scalar frequency in copper. So, you know, it's easily could be the case that, yeah, there are certain frequencies associated with scalar physics in copper and in other materials as well. But copper, is since it's a principal conductor we use in our electronics and in our circuitry, it's the scalar frequencies for copper are very important. They're very important for zero-point energy production. Most people, I don't think, understand this about these frequencies. Some of the people who are doing free energy research would benefit to know about these frequencies, the scalar frequencies. For instance, in production of hydrogen from water, such as in the method of Stan Meyer, 6 kilohertz is a very important frequency. And then 480 kilohertz is another important frequency. These are, and then there's other scalar frequencies. 93 megahertz is another important scalar frequency.
Now these scalar frequencies, you had sent me a paper about a week ago about some design work you're doing. And you talk about copper and I think aluminum, and between the two is a mica dielectric.
Yeah, that's a scalar detector I'm designed in association with a Moray-style energy system.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that would be a scalar detector. Now, these scalar waves, are you can't detect them in the manner that you ordinarily detect electromagnetic waves, because the scalar waves don't have electric and magnetic fields. They're scalars. They have they're just basically particles that have no orientation or electric and magnetic fields. So detecting them isn't always so easy, and that's why that mica detector I described to you, or was in my notes. That's the design that detects maximum frequency. And another thing is phonons. You see, phonons produce these scalar waves in copper and in other conductors. And so the maximum frequency longitudinal phonons in copper produce a 3.1 terahertz signal, and that has associated with it a 96.1 micrometer wavelength scalar that it takes quite a bit of work to detect it just properly, and that's what that scalar detector was all about there.
Now let's touch on this the scalar electromagnetics.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's really not being taught at all. I mean, there's virtually no knowledge of it in mainstream science.
No.
Is that
that's
correct, right?
Mm-hmm.
So really, we have to start with the basics here, and you know, try to define, you know, what the scalar properties are. And we know it has a longitudinal component. You know, if we take two electromagnetic waves, okay, that cross one another, and if they're opposing, okay, the fields are opposing one another, you know, the fields essentially cancel out. And in mainstream science, the waves should vanish, shouldn't it? I mean,
they don't know what to, if you talk to almost any physicist, they will not be able to tell you what happens when you cancel two photons. This is very simple, Bill. Suppose you have two photons that are 180 degrees out of phase, and you superpose one on top of the other. The electric fields cancel, and the magnetic fields cancel. That means that the electromagnetic energy vanishes. Now, but if you had two units of energy originally, what happened to those two units of energy?
Right.
They had to go somewhere. And where did they go? They went into production of scalar waves. Instead of an electromagnetic wave, you've taken two electromagnetic waves and made a scalar wave out of it.
Mm-hmm. So these two electromagnetic waves, okay, these considered as transverse wave functions. And then we have what emerges out of this, okay, when these wave cancel is a scalar component or some sort of a longitudinal component then.
Well, I don't know if it necessarily would have to be longitudinal. Let's see now. It would be longitudinal largely because it would be propagating in the same direction as the photons, but without the electric and magnetic field. So it would be a longitudinal wave largely.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if it's exclusively limited to longitudinal waves. I think there is a transverse component there too.
Okay. Okay, because, Dr. Miles, you know, did some research work, you know, with these scalar waves, you know, with his test apparatus. And he discovered that these waves, you know, that Tesla was experimenting with travel at 1.5 times the speed of light.
I've heard that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's true or not. In my calculations, I assume they travel at the speed of light, but I could be wrong. I don't know.
Uh-huh. Well, he mentioned that they travel much faster than the speed of light, which I thought was rather interesting.
Could be.
And I wasn't quite sure how he measured it, if it was based on, doing some calculations.
Yeah,
you know, I wasn't exactly sure, you know, how he determined that that velocity. But yes, you know, I thought it was rather interesting that you know, here we have you know, a scalar function, you know, somehow attached to this you know, to these transverse wave functions, traveling much faster than the speed of light. So it's a fascinating curiosity, which then
I don't know if it's traveling faster than the speed of light or not. I'm not ready to sign on to the idea that they are traveling faster than the speed of light. There may be the effects are faster than the speed of light from one point to another along a transverse direction, but I think the wavefront itself probably propagates at the speed of light, but I'm not certain. You know, I'm a classically trained physicist. I tend to believe in the classical physics unless I'm forced to believe otherwise. Now, I've been forced to believe otherwise. I didn't just sign on to all this thing, you know, blindly. I checked everything out, and I'm working on it every day to check it out further. So, you know, I believe in scalar waves for a number of reasons. First thing, Bill, what happens when you cancel two photons? Ask any physicist. Go to any university and ask any physicist, what happens to the energy when you cancel two photons?
Mm-hmm. Well, the classical, I always thought that the classical answer would be, it would turn out to be zero.
That's
the classical
analysis. You have to conserve energy, too. And if you conserve energy, that energy has to go somewhere.
Right, exactly.
So you got to have a paradox here, or a dilemma, or something, whatever you want to call it. There's some situation where you've lost the electromagnetic energy. The electromagnetic energy has disappeared, but energy itself has to be conserved. That means that energy had to go somewhere, and where did it go? It went into scalar waves, according to my analysis.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're absolutely correct there.
When I was on Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell, I said, anybody, any physicist out there can give me an answer to this. I'll come back on the air and I'll admit I'm wrong. But you know, I didn't get even one physicist writing to me saying that he had an answer or she had an answer. I don't think there isn't a classical answer. You must include gauge transformations. You must think, well, when I say gauge, I'm talking about something that's more commonly used in classical electrodynamics, a terminology that's more commonly used. I could call them gauge waves, or I could call them scalar waves. I use the terms interchangeably. But this is associated with gauge transformations in classical electrodynamics. Unfortunately, in classical electrodynamics theory, they always tell you that these gauge waves don't do anything. But they do. This is where the action is. If you want to get some exciting physics, zero-point energy, anything along those lines, anti-gravity, you've got to go to gauge waves, or scalar waves, if you will.
When they teach this, like Maxwell's equations in college here, it just seems to me that they essentially throw the baby out with the bathwater here, when they try to consider this longitudinal component, just to simplify the work, okay, that's done conveying this knowledge in a college classroom, that to keep things simple, we're just going to consider everything within an inertial frame, and that's what we're going to teach to the student. But the real action here, okay, if we're going to get off this planet, using anti-gravity technology, we have to factor in, we have to deal with Maxwell's equations, not only, extended, within an inertial frame, but outside of it, so that we can, at least have an answer, towards developing, this anti-gravity technology.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. You have to include gauge transformations with Maxwell's equations if you want to include the exotic effects that we're talking about. Now, most physicists deal with Lorentz transformations.
But right, right.
Lorentz transformation is a transformation from one inertial reference frame to another. And that's a velocity transformation. But these gauge transformations allow you to move from point A to point B without moving in through the space in between. Some of these UFOs, for instance, they go zip, 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 zip all over the sky, right?
Right,
and
correct.
And they do that through gauge transformations, in according to my analysis.
Now, what do you think is, the experimental effect here, that they're doing? Do you have any idea, what they might be doing?
You mean in UFOs?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, apparently it has to do with scalar waves and gauge transformations, and what they do is they set up a system where they create the right kind of scalar wave, and that it gets into very complicated theory, but it has to do with the electromagnetic coupling constant and the unified field theory that Einstein did not finish. I'm sort of working on it myself. It turns out, according to my theory, that the electromagnetic coupling constant would be responsible in some way for all of the forces. All of the forces would be unified through the electromagnetic coupling constant, and the electromagnetic coupling constant is not constant, according to my theory. So if you can make the electromagnetic coupling constant go to zero on the surface of a craft, you can make the inertial mass go to zero, for one thing. So if you make the inertial mass go
to zero... Now, is one way of affecting this this coupling constant is through this these interactions of these fields.
Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the work of John Hutchison?
Oh, yes. I've had him on my show several times.
Well, John Hutchison, I believe that's what he's doing. When he levitates objects, I believe that he's creating gauge transformations and basically modifying the electromagnetic coupling constant, at least on the surface of these objects, such as 70-pound cannonballs, has 70-pound cannonballs floating around.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently what he's doing is he's zeroing out the electromagnetic coupling constant on the surface of those objects. And that's also how he transmutes metals. For instance, he can take a piece of 3-inch by 3-inch by 12-inch piece of aluminum and turn it into, or steel, and turn it into a a flayed piece of something. I don't know.
Well, you know, Doctor, he does that at room temperature.
Oh, yeah.
That's absolutely amazing.
Mm-hmm. Well, there would be no need for the rise in temperature. If you can change the electromagnetic coupling constant, then you can do anything. According to my analysis, you can have room temperature nuclear fusion. You know, you can move a pion from inside of a carbon nucleus into the inside of an aluminum nucleus, things like that. You can do deterministic engineering of even nuclear physics and quantum physics. It turns out the indeterminacy of quantum physics goes away with the gauge transformations, according to my analysis.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, John, he levitated that 70-pound bowling ball, you know, that
cannonball.
The cannonball. And I thought that was rather amazing.
Now, where is there a conventional physicist that would explain that?
Yes, absolutely.
They won't. But we don't need to go to anything that exotic. Let's just get one conventional physicist tell us how or what happens to two canceling photons. What happens to the energy? I want to know. I'm a PhD nuclear physicist. I don't know. I mean, I do know if I put gauge transformations in there, if I put gauge waves in, but if I don't put gauge waves or scalar waves in there, then I don't know what happens to that energy.
Right.
There's no answer. The conventional electrodynamics is flawed.
Now, you mentioned something rather interesting here, and that is, this cancellation of fields. And I first heard about this this cancellation experiment from David Cereda. You know, he gave a presentation just a few months ago at the Laughlin UFO Congress, and I was there at the time. I caught his lecture, and he was playing his video of an experiment performed by Boyd Bushman, who is a senior scientist for Lockheed Aerospace. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was just kind of curious where Boyd got this idea from, because the president of that organization, of that corporation, Ben Rich, mentioned somewhat in deathbed communications here of revealing some of these secrets that Lockheed has, that Lockheed possesses technology that they can take ET home.
Well, that's what they say. I don't know whether that's true or not. I do know that, remember Colonel Corso?
Yes.
Colonel Corso. Well, he provided a drawing that was supposedly from extraterrestrials that showed this magnetic field cancellation technology in a diagram. And so apparently it's at least 40 or 50 or 60 years old, the idea, the transfer of the information. And I know of another instance where a person who supposedly came in contact with a extraterrestrial, the extraterrestrial told him also that they use canceling electric and magnetic fields.
Uh-huh. Well, so, you know, I think that's a key there.
I'm sorry?
You know, that's a key.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's no doubt about it. Well, you know, if you take conventional electrodynamics and you start canceling out energies and you have to account for those energy, you can't just throw energy away, right? I mean, there's a law of energy conservation is more fundamental than electrodynamics. It has to do with the homogeneity of space and time. So you can't just throw away energy. Now, if you're canceling electromagnetic energy, it's got to go somewhere, and it's probably going to go into waves because that's how nature works. When it receives energy, it puts it into waves. So some sort of wave is being produced when you cancel electromagnetic energy. Let's call it scalar waves. Let's call it gauge waves, as I call them sometimes.
Well, Doctor, we have an email here from Andrew in California. He says, hi, Bill. You know, some time ago, you had Tom Van Flandern on reporting that there was experimental evidence that gravity travels far faster than light. Does Dr. Kuntz have any opinion or follow-up on this?
I can't speak to that issue. I don't know, to tell you the truth. That's outside of my realm of expertise.
Okay. There's a second one here by Andrew. He says, my point being, does this mean that gravity is a scalar wave, thus obsoleting general relativity?
Well, it could be a scalar wave. I don't know. I'm not an expert in general relativity. I'll have to ask a friend of mine. By the way, I've asked other physicists about this canceling photon business, and I'd never get an answer. Never get into satisfactory answer.
Well, it's a taboo subject.
Oh, yeah. Well, some physicists, you know, are open-minded, you know, but they don't always have jobs anymore, you know. They're guerrilla physicists. A friend of mine is a guerrilla physicist. He's a really good general relativist, and he believes that the universe is not did not undergo a big bang. And so he's out. You know, they excommunicated him.
Uh-huh.
Hey, listen, while we're talking about, before we get too far along, I just want to mention something about these UFOs and all that. Are you familiar with the work of Dr. Roger Lear?
Yes.
With these alien implants?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, listen, I'll tell you something. If this really true, I believe it, you know, these implants apparently have non-terrestrial isotopic ratios. When they did careful analysis of the materials, they emit radiation in the scalar wave frequencies, and under using scanning electron microscopes, they blow the get good pictures of the insides of these things, and there's microstructure in there of a technological nature. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this. Even American scientists are being taken away in the middle of the night and having things stuck in their bodies, apparently tracking devices or who knows what they do. You know, are these our friends, these extraterrestrials? Are we supposed to like these guys that come in here in the middle of the night and take us away and put things in our bodies? I consider this a national security issue, a national security threat, actually.
Yes.
My fiancée
has had numerous contacts with human-appearing ETs.
Who?
And she also talks about these negative ETs, too.
Mm-hmm.
And, just doing some research in this subject, I come to the conclusion that they were called the Archons. And they include these grays and these reptilians that invaded our world system here. And Jay Widener, we had on last hour here, he seems to think that they invaded this Earth 6,000 years ago and were part of some sort of a Luciferian rebellion that broke out. And that we have this conflict, this war in space going on between these negative ETs and this galactic federation, you know, that surrounds this planet. And Aurora and Michael Elejon, who comes on the next hour here in his Cosmic Connections, have had numerous contact with these human-appearing ETs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's something going on here that is absolutely incredible.
It is incredible, Bill. And I'll tell you something else. You know, people are not looking around. They're not seeing what's going on. There's a tremendous amount of UFO activity in our skies. There's a lot going on, and I'm a little concerned about some of this. And I'm not mm-hmm. look. I worked against the Soviets. I'm an old Cold Warrior. You know, I'm not really that spooked by much of anything. Sometimes I get a little spooked, but you know, this is a matter of concern when scientists have implants put in their bodies in the middle of the night for who knows what reason. Not only scientists, but ordinary people. What in the world's going on?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not a good situation.
And this electronics that apparently, that's in these little chips that are implanted is quite advanced.
Oh, yeah.
If they are using the scalar electronics, this is quite a sophisticated technology that people are being implanted with.
Absolutely. I agree with you. And listen, I'll tell you something. These little devices, they may only be 5 millimeters long and maybe 1 or 2 or 3 millimeters wide in diameter, but they could be putting out a couple hundred watts,
mm-hmm.
free energy. And what in the world are they doing? Are they tracking people? Are they collecting intelligence? Are they controlling people's emotions, perhaps? Who knows? I'll tell you something, Bill. If enough of these devices got implanted in the right people, we could end up on a slave planet someday.
Right. Well, something very interesting happened over there at the Laughlin UFO Congress. Jaime Masson was there, from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And he was there with his detection equipment, scanning people. People can be scanned for these implants.
I see.
And he was actually performing, I think, a valuable service,
mm-hmm.
scanning people for any kind of unusual frequencies. So
mm-hmm.
He had a couple of assistants there, moving an antenna detector and an oscilloscope,
mm-hmm.
and scanning people. To see if they have an implant.
Well, that's possible to do, but I'll tell you something. Probably the emissions from those implants generally are hard to detect with ordinary electromagnetic devices because of the nature of scalar waves. There might be sidebands in the normal electromagnetic spectrum, but probably they're mostly emitting scalar waves. So if you pick something up, I think you're a little bit lucky. Scalar waves aren't so easy to detect.
Yes.
For instance, that Mica detector that you talked about, that's quite a design task in order to build that scalar detector.
Uh-huh. Well, that's very thought-provoking, actually. If we have these little chips implanted in people using scalar electronics that could essentially pump out, let's say 100 watts,
right.
These entities, and their ships can be, thousands of miles away and monitor people.
Mm-hmm.
Track them and monitor them, from a very remote distance. And, the scalar electronics could be traveling. There's the possibility that this is almost instantaneous communications.
Mm-hmm.
There is that possibility.
Whether it's instantaneous or not, it's still, to me, a national security concern. I'll tell you what I think happened, Bill. I'm pretty sure that 40 or 50 or 60 or however many years ago it was, maybe around the time of Roswell, we started covering all this stuff up, and now we're in so deep we're in over our heads. I used to be I used to teach at the National Security Agency when I was in the Navy. And I know something about the way secrets can have a life of their own. I'm mm-hmm. pretty sure that what happened is our national security people covered this whole thing up. They didn't want the people to get panicked. Year after year, they lived a lie. Now we're into the point where these extraterrestrials are possibly putting implants or probably are putting implants in people. Now what? They're in the door.
Mm-hmm.
And the national security people have been living a lie so long. Some of the national security people have been living a lie, not all.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of good people in the national security community. I really respected the people I work with, but some small group of people have kept the lid on this thing, and they kept it secret. And now, who knows what situation we're in?
Well, Stephen Bassett over there in Washington, he runs the X Conference, and I attended a few of his conferences there, and he's really pushing hard, you know, to try to get this this matter, you know, exposed to the public. But there just seems to be this tremendous resistance, you know, from the government, you know, this code of silence. And it seems like the only other ones coming forward are you know, countries like France and I think Brazil came forward with some information.
Right, Brazil. Well, of course, we're you know, we're the big dog in the family. I mean, if the United States doesn't come forward, these other countries, what they say won't mean so much.
Mm-hmm.
The United States has to come clean. You know, look, I tell you something, Bill. I'm a down-to-earth experimental nuclear physicist. I am not very fanciful in the things that I believe in. I took a picture of a flying saucer. It was not a blob in the sky. It was a flying saucer. Now, what in the world's going on? Do we have flying saucers in our fleet scooting around all over the world? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Something's going on.
Unless it's some sort of a black op program.
Well, I'm not too much for believing in some of these black op programs. Now, there are black ops programs, but I don't think that flying saucer I took a picture of was a black ops program.
Well, you know, I've done a fair amount of research with this device called the Nazi Bell. And, you know, this, from the evidence that I've run across, I mean, this thing was for real. It was an anti-gravity device.
Oh, yeah.
And I had Igor Wachowski on my show just a few weeks ago. And he was the one who originally uncovered this device. And then another author by the name of Dr. Joe Farrell picked the ball up, you know, and he wrote several books about this Nazi
device. He's a good writer. Yeah. But listen, I'll tell you something. The Nazis apparently had some sort of flying saucers. I don't know how well they worked, but they had some sort of scalar technology that was doing something for them. And I don't know exactly how they got that technology, but they were working on anti-gravity.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Igor wrote an article in the Nexus magazine a couple of months back, and I just happened to run across his article. And he mentioned in this article that, you know, the Germans rejected general relativity, you know, Einstein's general relativity, you know, because it just does not explain, okay, or go into, you know, electrogravitics. Mm-hmm. And what Igor mentioned was that in his article that it, you know, that this phenomena that the Germans were experimenting with had to do with spin of fundamental particles.
Yeah.
That gravity was related to spin.
I see. Yeah.
Now, there was an experiment on Bruce De Palma's website. I don't know if you're familiar with Bruce De Palma.
It's on M Machine or something like that.
Right, right. Well, there's some fascinating research reports he did, you know, with spinning balls. Mm-hmm. That if you take a steel ball and you spin it, and I think it was spinning at somewhere around 30,000 RPM or so. People can go to this website to get the details. But it reacted very differently than a non-spinning ball. You know, when he launched it in this parabolic path, the spinning steel ball flew higher and fell faster. Okay, then a non-spinning ball. And he documented this evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And then these other researchers came along with spinning gyroscopes. And when they dropped a spinning gyroscope compared with a non-spinning gyroscope, the spinning gyroscope fell faster. Okay, and they actually measured this, you know, and posted these results. And these are, you know, experiments, you know, they're simple experiments that you just don't hear about in mainstream science at all. You know, it's like a taboo subject. But yet, you know, it seems like gravity has a spin component associated with it, that if you have these spinning objects, they react differently in a gravitational field. And then with Boyd Bushman's experiment, when I replicated his experiment with the opposing magnetic fields, you know, I observed that these rocks, they indeed fell faster. Mm-hmm. Okay. When the field is an attractive configuration, it fell faster, but when it's opposing, it fell slower. You know, just as Boyd Bushman reported. So there seems to be some sort of a link with magnetism. Because magnetism has an aligned spin fields associated with them. Okay.
Well, that would be consistent with production of scalar energy or a scalar field. And when you're canceling the magnetic fields, you're producing a scalar field around the magnet.
Uh huh.
Now, your particular experiment, I'd like to see you refine that a little bit. It's not quite the signal-to-noise ratio is not quite big enough to convince me, and it's suggestive. I believe you're in the right direction. I believe you're in the ballpark. I'd like to see you get a factor of 5 increase in the signal to noise ratio, and then I would say you really did something important. I mean, this is not a minor thing we're talking about, Bill. If you're successful in doing what you showed in that video, YouTube video, this is one of the most important experiments you could ever do in your whole life, any physicist. Okay.
I see Michael was doing a drop test and I was videotaping it. And Michael suggested, you know, we need some way of precisely releasing these rocks, you know, to get a proper test. We need to precisely release these simultaneously.
Yeah, that's what I said in the message I sent to you.
Right.
I did some calculations.
Yeah.
You've got to release them about no more than 5 or 10 milliseconds apart. You've got to release them together within 5 milliseconds or 10 milliseconds for your experiment to actually prove what you wanted to prove. Now, listen, I think you did suggestively prove, not prove, but it's suggestive. Your results are suggestive. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And
I was looking to do at the time is just to have some sort of a validation of what Boyd Bushman had experimented with, you know, that he talked about in that video.
Right.
And it was just something that I had laying around in the garage here. I had a few neodymium magnets laying around. I said, you know, I can duplicate that, you know, just to get an idea, you know,
Bill, let me say this. Why don't you take that experiment to the next step? If you can refine that experiment and get it down to the point where you can really demonstrate that phenomena, then you've got something you can show the world and really be very, very, very proud about, because that's inconsistent with all of modern physics.
Right.
As it's taught
exactly.
In universities. Basically, what you did was you put two magnets in opposition and epoxied them together, if I'm correct.
Yes, that's correct.
And then you put them in a shroud or put them in a rock-like thing and dropped both balls, one with the magnets opposing and one with not.
Right.
And the one where they opposed came to the Earth later than the one that...
Yes, it fell slower. Yeah. I had my control rock, which is just a rock that I picked up in the backyard here.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just wrap it up with electrical tape.
Why don't you refine that experiment, Bill?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you refine that experiment? I'm encouraging you to do that experiment to the point where you can get a real good signal-to-noise ratio, and then you can really rock the world.
That would be an incredible demonstration.
That's not an inconsequential experiment. That's a very important experiment you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Very important.
You know, Boyd Bushman, you know, Lockheed, according to David Sureda, and who incidentally lives over here in Sedona, he's just over the hill from me, David mentioned that Lockheed took Boyd Bushman's experiment a step further, and they actually developed... Back in the late 90s, you know, some anti-gravity technology where they took these these large, they made large coils, okay, yeah. And they hooked it up. According to David, they hooked it up to a nuclear battery or some sort of a nuclear generator that generate electricity, mm-hmm. and they put these two opposing magnetic fields together and built a huge multi-kilowatt unit. Mm-hmm. And apparently they flew this thing around in an airplane. And, you know, the Lockheed took it a step further, you know. I mean, just building this this massive device.
On my website, drkuntz.com, you'll find a link where it says, what does it say? Website, let's see. Can dark energy be produced in the laboratory? And you'll see that I have an experiment. I did an experiment with a bifilar coil, a very large bifilar coil, where I had current flowing in opposite directions in the coil. And adjacent wires had current flowing in opposite directions. I got canceling magnetic fields. And I tell you, Bill, I was able to move the clouds over the house with that thing.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. There's a tremendous amount of energy in these scalar fields. Now, it's a very, very, very complicated thing. It's more complicated than quantum physics. I go through this. It simplifies sometimes, but it gets complicated and gets simplified and complicated. It's very, very complicated. But you can do some simple experiments, and the energy that's available is tremendous. Basically, it's infinite. An infinite amount of energy is available at 0 point. Now, here's why, Bill. If you make, suppose you start with 0 units of energy. If you make 1 unit of positive energy by itself, that would be a violation of the law of energy conservation. But if you make 1 positive unit of energy and at the same time make 1 unit of negative energy, that does not violate energy conservation. So if you make positive energy, that's okay, as long as you make an equal amount of negative energy, and you can do that by making negative energy scalar waves. So basically, it does not violate the law of energy conservation to produce free energy.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
As long as you you balance out the energy, 0 point energy, zero. Zero equals 1 plus minus 1.
Uh-huh.
It's as simple as that.
Yes. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, doctor, we have only a minute left. You know, this hour just flew by.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, you can give out your website and anything else that is coming up here.
Okay. My website is drkoontz.com, drkoontz.com. There's a fair amount of interesting things there to read. Let me just say that I think this people ought to keep their heads up on this UFO business, because I'm not so sure that these guys are our friends. I'll tell you, you can take a look at that picture of that flying saucer. You can look around on the Internet. You can see the evidence is there. We're being visited, and it looks like there was implants being put in people. So I would say people ought to stay awake.
Okay, Dr. Kuntz, thank you for coming on the air here. Fascinating hour.
Thank you, Bill. Take care.
Thank you
yourself.
Very much. Okay, bye-bye. Very good. That was Dr. Kuntz. You know, he's an experimental physicist, nuclear physicist, a great guest. I'd like to have him on again. Well, coming up next is Michael Elejon as he explores cutting-edge contacts with cosmic beings. That's next on Achieve Radio. Have a great day, everyone. Hello everyone, this is Bill Alec. In this new book that just premiered at the Academy of Arts and Sciences in Hollywood, California, delves into our connection with human-appearing extraterrestrials. In Prepare for the Landings, authors Michael Elejon and Aurora Light go into their long-standing contacts and what's in store for all of us here on planet Earth. In Prepare for the Landings, you will learn why this planet has been quarantined and how the ET connection to the Bible and other ancient writings has been deliberately suppressed. Go to prepareforthelandings.com and prepare yourself for the coming shift of the ages taking place right now. That's prepareforthelandings.com. Get your copy today and don't be left behind. Go to prepareforthelandings.com.
Are you ready for the truth? Tune in to Native American Psychic with Cherokee Billy every Saturday afternoon. Call in for phone advice with psychic accuracy on romance, career, and life. With a lifetime of dedication to a spiritual, intuitive, and naturopathic way of life, Cherokee Billy offers sincere and loving guidance to all who come to her with open hearts and minds. She loves giving readings to those who call in. Or got a deeper issue? Contact Cherokee Billy privately. In only a few minutes with clairvoyant Cherokee Billy, you will get solutions and straightforward answers to your most burning questions on love and relationships, money and career matters, making important decisions, providing clarity when you have none, identifying personal blocks that hold you back, achieve success and prosperity, communicate with deceased loved ones, gain control of your life. Visit CherokeeBilly.com today or call 866-563-3997. The most affordable, reliable psychic on the web. Only $1.50 a minute. You heard right. $1.50 a minute. So call today, 866-563-3997.